Where does it come from, the inspiration to want to heal people and for rehab? How do we know who's the right person to listen to?
What about supplements? What do you feel about those? What are some things that those who are up in age can do to live a healthy life as long as possible?
Tom Walters, thank you for being here on Sauna Sessions. We're inside of an infrared sauna. I'm sweating. You said you're a heavy sweater. I'm not seeing it. Okay, I see a little.
It's starting to come. It's coming. Yeah. Thanks for having me so much. This is awesome. Like I'm saying, just amazing opportunity. Cool to meet you. I've been following your stuff for a while, and nice to be here and talk about stuff like we're saying that I think will help people. So thank you.
Is the infrared sauna, is that a big rehab method? Is that a...
You know, it's not talked about a lot in rehab. You know, I think... That's just because a lot of rehab practitioners, it takes a long time for things to kind of infiltrate that world. And we talked about it in the book, and I think we kind of thought of it as this complementary type of thing you could do to the kind of mainstay education, exercise, stuff like that. But I mean, I've seen, you know, there's all that research now on, you know, cardiovascular benefits, the heat shock proteins. I think it'd be really interesting. I haven't seen a study, but it'd be interesting to take an injured population and use sauna and... objectively track, maybe it's muscle strains or something like that is a, you know, maybe a protein specific kind of injury and see what happens with it.
I keep getting these ads on my Instagram for like this targeted red light. Is there any research on the efficacy of that?
Yeah, I haven't seen great. The laser kind of stuff, like different lights, cold laser. We used it for a while in the clinic back in the day, but it seems it's so hard to truly study those and get away from placebo.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
there you go. That's the problem, right? It's like, which mindset's a huge thing. And you know, there are a lot of interventions that are highly placebo based. And, you know, I think sometimes that can be good. But in general, most of the research in the rehab world is trying to figure out what are the things that have like true efficacy and aren't just placebo.
There's so many people in pain in our modern world today. What are we doing to ourselves, or is society, is the way that we live, is that hurting us? And what's the solution?
Yeah, I think a huge part of it is like the Western world and all these factors that kind of we know are associated with pain now. You know, I think when you put all these things together, this is why chronic pain is so hard to solve, because you've got all these things coming together that are just a part of how we've evolved as a species. And to peel those and take them away is so hard at this point. But I think everything you look at, from pro-inflammatory kind of nutrition things happening in Western diets and people being more sedentary, for sure, you know, being sedentary, we talk about in the research, seeing that people have more pro-inflammatory cytokines when they're sedentary, and those are diminished when they exercise. Stress, right? Like stress is so huge now. I think before we were more like the animal kingdom, where it was like you were stressed when you needed to be and then you calmed down. You know, and now we just, I think, psychologically are thinking there's so much going on that we're in a stress state so much more. And those are all really tied to sensitivity in the nervous system and the development of chronic pain.
It's kind of like a perfect storm with so many things. I guess the big one is the stress. And I want to get to that, because you have a perspective in your book about dealing with pain and dealing with stress to mitigate issues that we have in our bodies. I have my background in cultural anthropology.
Nice.
And so I love studying different cultures and how they live compared to how we live. Have you gotten into this research? Are there any cultures that, like, for instance, ones that they might eat dinner in a seated position with no chairs and they get up a lot, or... you know, indigenous cultures that walk barefoot and they walk a lot. Do you know of any cultures that may not be immune but don't have the issues that we have in a modern society?
Yeah, I mean, you definitely see from kind of different perspectives changes in other cultures. There's some really interesting kind of pain ones where we know pain is tied to the meaning of things. And so, like, if something means danger to you, you're more likely to experience pain. And we see cultures who do fire walking. In the Philippines, there are voluntary crucifixions at Easter time, and they report very little pain, but it's like it has this cultural significance to them. So it's positive, and because of that, they don't report that much pain.
Voluntary crucifixion.
Can you believe that?
Wow.
I mean,
never
imagine,
heard of that one.
Dude, like, so... yeah, there's crazy images online of these individuals doing these things. And, you know, to anybody else who didn't carry that deep meaning, it would create probably a way more severe pain experience. You know, on the other side, I think a lot of, especially like Asian cultures come to mind for me, on a lot of times when you travel, we lived in Bali for a little while and place and just have traveled and seen some of these places, but I think a lot of times people have a healthier BMI. They're just, not only is their healthier weight for their frame, but then you also see them using their range of motion through greater degrees. And I think a lot of Westerners do, like, you know, you'll see so many people in Asia in a deep squat just hanging out there. You know, it's just like their position. And we know, you know, for things like the knee joint, that going through full range of motion like that actually helps to keep the cartilage healthy. Mm. Anytime you're making this prediction years in the future of what's going to happen, it's a little tricky, but I think that probably plays a role. Look at how many total knee operations there are in Western countries. And again, it goes back to all those factors, like, you know, all the diet factors and stress and people being sedentary. The ones that are most interesting to me are these pain studies, where it's like, in that culture, the act that would usually cause a lot of pain is meaningful to them in a positive way.
So interesting.
Which happens to us too, you know, like if you imagine, that happens a lot with athletes. Like if you engage in a sport, athletes often have a very high pain tolerance threshold, especially like endurance athletes, martial artists. Like I'm really into MMA and you see that a lot in that population, but they are participating in something that is positive and meaningful to them, and that can change the danger or the threat that comes from it, which ultimately means a lot of times they have less pain doing it.
That's fascinating. One of my favorite sayings is, watch what you eat, watch what you drink, and watch what you think. And the mind is so important, and you're kind of echoing that even more. I had no idea certain cultures actually put themselves through these painful rituals, and they don't have the same degree of I guess hurt or pain or feeling that somebody who didn't have that significance towards that act would. That's fascinating. Yeah. So 10 years ago, I hurt my rotator cuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's my left one. Yeah. The reason was because I never went to a doctor. You know, I think where I grew up, we didn't have the money and something, maybe 15 years. So I'm like, I think it was because I was doing too much overhead press, not enough rear delt. What do you call it? An impingement?
Impingement, yep,
yeah.
Yep.
I heard it just like slamming a car door. Mm-hmm. I was like, this pain. And it took almost a year for it to get better. And back then, it was like the whole Rice method, right?
Yep.
Rest, ice, compression, elevation. Yeah. And I didn't move it, you know, too much. I'm trying to keep it still. But things have changed since then, right?
Yeah, Rice has kind of gone away. A lot of this research looking at ice actually delaying the healing response. Because, you know, it's like we were using ice to knock down inflammation, but inflammation is technically the first stage of healing.
Huh.
So, you know, you'll still see ice sometimes used if you want to just reduce pain. You know, ice can be useful for that. So can heat, actually. Mm. And then sometimes really big surgeries, surgeons will still use ice to kind of control that swelling response a little bit. But most of the time now with soft tissue injuries, like a rotator cuff kind of injury, the more current thinking is called peace and love. And So the British Journal of Sports Medicine published this a few years back, and it basically looks at protection. You still see elevation, you see compression. The L is actually loaded movement. So you put load on it, but gradually, right? Like that's the whole mobility piece that I think luckily such a major focus nowadays. Cause I mean, I had knee surgery in high school. I remember I got put in a brace, my knee straight for 6 weeks, and that stuff doesn't really happen anymore. You know, you might immobilize people for a little bit, but really the goal is get people moving right away. Even after big orthopedic operations in the hospital, they're usually getting people out of bed the same day or the next day. It's changed. Ice is out of the picture now. You still have compression, elevation, even rest, right? Like rest, temporary rest is okay, but it's usually not, you know, you would back in the day, you'd hear people say, oh, my doctor told me just to rest until this gets better. And there's so many issues, so many conditions that actually don't improve with rest. And you have all this other deconditioning and atrophy that happens, right? When you're just sedentary. And like the rotator cuff tendon, tendons are a great example. Tendons will become less painful while you're resting, but as soon as you put stress on them, the pain will come right back. And so you really have to challenge them. The research has shown so many tissues in the musculoskeletal system that if you challenge it gradually, that's actually what makes it better.
It's so funny you say that because I don't have too many injuries. That was the main big injury I've ever had, the biggest injury I've ever had in my life. I had something in my toe, in my big toe. And basically I was running in like sandals, and I like hyperextended, I guess, or pulled it back like this. Yeah. And it was months, man. It was painful. It didn't have, my big toe didn't have much range of motion. Then I met with this guy, Paul Check. I don't know if you're familiar with his work.
Yep.
He was saying, just massage it, create more blood flow into it and bend it. And And within a few weeks, I was like, oh, this has gotten a lot better.
I totally agree. All that. I mean, when you look at rehab and when people come to physical therapy, the first step is to kind of get pain calmed down. But the next step is regain mobility. And we do that through both passive and active mobility kind of drills. But passive mobility drills are like where you could be taught to do it yourself, like you did with your toe, or a practitioner takes your joint and moves it where you're just staying relaxed, you know, and that stuff, especially in little joints like toes and fingers, you really have to start working on mobility quickly because they'll get really stiff.
Okay.
And so, yeah, that makes a ton of sense, you know. And then, of course, there's like little toe yoga kind of exercises you can do later on. But with those joints, and I mean, really every kind of major joint, mobility is so huge after an injury. It's really, like I say, you can think about getting your pain kind of calmed down, work on mobility, and then start strengthening it.
You have such a passion when you speak, and I see it in your eyes. And where does it come from, the inspiration to want to heal people and for rehab? Where did that come from?
I mean, I love teaching. I love education. I taught at a college in a kinesiology program for 8 years. And I think before that, when I was in high school, I taught taekwondo. I was big into taekwondo, and that was my main sport. And I think I didn't realize at the time, but I just really like teaching and seeing people kind of get those light bulb moments and seeing it change their kind of perception of things. And it was so huge for me to have instructors and teachers, and just one little cue or change in wording could totally change. That happened to me a lot in sports where I'd hear a cue for a long time, but then somebody would say a slightly different one, and all of a sudden it would change how my brain did the movement. I all of a sudden understood. I remember I was in gymnastics in high school. I remember doing back handsprings. I was doing this combination, and my gymnastics coach said this one little tweak on the normal cue, and all of a sudden my movement system in my brain understood it better.
Wow.
That stuff's really cool to see with people who have pain and injury, but I think to me, there's so many people that don't understand pain and injury well, and there's a lot of kind of harmful messages out there around it, especially nowadays on social media. There's a lot of good stuff too, but there's a lot of harmful stuff that I think makes people feel like their body's really fragile, makes them not trust it.
Okay.
And that stuff is really frustrating to me. And so that was a lot of why I got started doing this. Not only am I just like obsessive about the information, like I just love the musculoskeletal system and the ways it can adapt through exercise, but I also think hearing people, having patients come in to see me who had heard a message that, you know, just was harmful to them, that was really frustrating. And so I really wanted to combat against that.
Get into that. Like you mentioned education and pain. What is getting proper education about pain? What does that do in the healing process?
Yeah, it's huge. It's, you know, because we've talked about mindset a little bit. Your mindset, if you understand what pain is and how the pain system works, there's a lot of research, especially out of Australia on this. It basically helps to desensitize your pain system and your nervous system, because pain is ultimately outputted by your brain when it perceives that you are threatened. Actually, if you even look at the main definition for pain, it's a sensory and emotional experience that's associated with actual or potential tissue damage. So you can, of course, have actual tissue damage, like you hurt something, you know, you twist your ankle and then you have pain, but you can also have pain if your brain just thinks there's the potential for tissue damage.
Wow.
So it's all about threat. And I think with pain science education, what you see in people is that when they understand what pain is and how that pain system works, it's not so threatening anymore. And then their whole system kind of, it winds down, it kind of ramps down, which goes back to those other factors. Like if you already, you hurt something and you've got some pain, like say you twist your ankle or you hurt your back. So you're picking your kids up or whatever and you hurt your back. If you're already got a stressful job or a stressful relationship, you're not sleeping enough, right? That's a huge one. You have a diet that's very pro-inflammatory. It's like you said, it's the perfect storm for turning that pain from this acute kind of pain that might heal in the normal time frame to becoming this chronic pain that spreads and stays there even after the tissue's healed.
Okay, so how do we find proper education? Because there's so many people on social media, like you said. It's like, how do we know who's the right person to listen to? Or
having the right filters, like there's so much information on every topic online. And I think probably the hallmark of situations maybe to avoid are the ones who claim that there's a quick fix. Like, this is the fix for your chronic back pain, or, you know, just kind of exaggerated claims. You know, if you see something like that, because the people who really are following the evidence and the science on it are going to always have a certain degree of uncertainty, and they're going to respect that uncertainty. And sometimes uncertainty comes off as less confidence when you're a practitioner. But I think if people are in pain and they're looking for resources, don't immediately be turned off by someone that's expressing uncertainty, because it just means that they're understanding the complexity of it and not selling you on BS.
So good. It's like uncertainty is, it's not what you want if you want to take advantage of the algorithm, right? You want like bold claims, the quick fixes. This is it. This is the solution. You want to be as provocative as you can be. But I agree with you. And I think a true scientist, it's all about doubt. Mm-hmm. It's all about keeping an open mind, being curious, looking at all sides, all evidences that are available to us. I agree. I think that's a great takeaway, to not shy away from somebody that doesn't appear like they have all the answers. But get into the placebo effect, though.
Yeah.
Right? Because sometimes that overconfidence can be a benefit.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And I think back to what you were saying a second ago, like if you hear someone, a lot of times in the PT world, we'll say it depends. Mm. And that's just, that's okay. Like, it depends. Like, each person is unique. Each person's body, their biology, their pain system is unique. There isn't a one-size-fits-all for everything. And, you know, when you get into the placebo, the people who are going to tell you this is the instant fix, they are, a lot of times, taking advantage of that placebo. Wow. They're getting buy-in from you. Because belief, our thoughts, emotions, our beliefs are a huge part. I mean, they say sometimes that up to 50% of medical interventions are placebo-based. There's even surgeries, like surgery for tennis elbow, where they take people who have tennis elbow on both sides. They won't tell them which side's going to have actual surgery and which side has the sham surgery, and people have equal outcomes. The same with, they'll take people with meniscus tears, and they'll have all these people come in with symptomatic meniscus tears with knee pain. They'll say, okay, some of you are going to have a sham surgery where they only put in the portal site, so it looks like you had surgery. The other group's going to actually have surgery. But you don't know which group you're in. Almost equal outcomes. You know, this stuff's happening everywhere, even if you have good intentions. They've actually shown this with tooth pain, like toothache pain, that when people are having that pain, their pain will dramatically reduce once they enter the dentist's office, because they have this belief that, okay, I'm somewhere that's going to fix this. And I'm safe in that belief. You know, their brain's like, okay, I don't need to output as much pain because they've done something about this, and it's going to get fixed. One of the great ways to think about pain is like this teacher. And I think you want to think about, if you're having pain, what's making my brain feel threatened? Is it stress? Is it the things I'm eating in my diet? Is it a lack of movement and exercise? Is it some harmful belief that I've learned from a family or a friend or a practitioner told me, or I read on the internet? Like, what are these things? What's sort of winding my system up? How can I work on peeling back those layers and getting rid of some of those things and kind of trying to wind the system back down? Maybe you just need like a meditation kind of practice where you're just, maybe that's your way, because stress is such a huge one. That's a big tangent from placebo.
I love it. And you actually have the wheels in my brain turning now, because what I'm thinking is, you know, I feel that the body kind of heals itself once we kind of get rid of everything that's blocking it from being healed. And a big block, it must be the stress. So it's like once you walk into the doctor's office or the dentist's office, that stress is no longer blocking you. And so the body can kind of do what it's supposed to do, which is kind of bring the body back to homeostasis.
Exactly. Well, stress is a good thing too, right? Like acute stress responses are good. You want those if something really dangerous, if the car's about to hit you and you're on the freeway, you want to have that quick stress response is just staying in it. So I think it's true with pain like that. If something really hurts you, that stress is good. It's going to motivate you to go seek care and figure it out. And, you know, so many people are not good about seeking care. Like a lot of guys are guilty of this, right? Where they just don't go. You hear of that with older generations especially. And maybe that promotes them getting chronic back pain or something because they're worried about it, but they also don't want to go seek care. And so many facets to it. I mean, this is why, again, chronic pain is so hard to fully solve. You know, somebody tells you they got a quick fix for it. We'd all know about it by now.
Are there any people, or maybe it's you, but people that I'm living in this body, you know, pretty much stress-free. I mean, I've got the stress on, stress off, not total stress, but like have kind of got it together.
Yeah, that's an interesting one to think about. Yeah, people who have it totally dialed in. It takes a certain amount of vulnerability to share about some of these things, you know, and there are people who I would think that I see from externally, I think they probably have it dialed in, but who knows? It's been a journey for me. I'm not by any means perfect at it. I am naturally wired just to be a little more anxious and kind of wound up. And
yeah, me too.
Yeah, like that. Interestingly, I, years ago in jiu-jitsu, hurt one of my ribs, created this pain kind of on the front of my rib cage and then on the backside. You know, it's been 6 years ago and that pain spot still hurts me when I get stressed out. So it's about the size of a quarter. It's on my right side of my mid-back.
When you get stressed out.
Well, stress is the main driver. So it was originally a tissue injury, like I was doing something in jiu-jitsu and felt it get hurt, and I know now that even if it's good stress, like if I'm excited about coming here to talk to you or going on a vacation, it will hurt the night before. Mm. And I know that I'm, you know, maybe I'm holding muscle tension there. I don't know what it is. Maybe just that pain circuit is more sensitive. And for me, it's been an interesting journey. It's always kind of interesting to have pain as a PT, because then you can kind of empathize with people a little bit. You know, no pain is exactly the same, but going through this journey, even knowing all these things about pain, I still struggle with a pain thing that's technically probably more in the kind of chronic pain categories. It's been around for so long and isn't really associated so much with, you know, like a physical tissue injury.
Mm. That's so fascinating. Do you have any knowledge on like using visualization to heal? There's a few studies I'm familiar with that, like one study, for instance, people who they visualized themselves doing a bicep curl, and then they got like, I don't know, it was over like 7 weeks, they got like almost 20% stronger in their biceps, something crazy like that. And the whole free throw, you know, this one, the people who visualize shooting the free throw, they improved, I think, just as much as those people who actually practice shooting free throws.
Yep.
But when it comes to healing, I guess the practice of visualizing yourself being healed. Mm. Tell me, do you know any research or studies on that?
Yeah, that's a really interesting one. You know, I don't know that anybody's studied it from like looking at the stages of healing and seeing those progress more quickly, but there is a bunch. This is often referred to as mental imagery in the pain world, right? And you know, in sports, it can be so helpful to imagine yourself successfully going through the motions of that movement. And in the pain world, you actually see it for things where people are immobilized. Like say someone had back surgery. Mm. And they can't go do a lot of movements. They just aren't allowed to, or it hurts too much. They've actually shown that when people imagine bending and using their back, it fires those same motor circuits in their brain, and it helps them get better faster. Deconditioning is less because of that imagery process. And I think, you know, this also kind of ties in with this whole, maybe you've heard of the cross transfer phenomenon, where if you're injured on one arm, if you lift with the other arm, your strength losses are less on the other side.
I've not heard of that
one. Yeah, it's crazy. It can be both negative and positive. Most of the time we hear about it as a positive. This is why we always tell people, like, look, if you got one injured arm, one injured leg, do the other leg, because it's been shown that your nervous system through that connection can help reduce strength loss in the injured side, versus if you take people who just don't do anything, you compare the two groups. Sometimes this is thought to where if you see people who have like an Achilles tear, for example, or an ACL rupture, sometimes they're more likely to have that on the other side. And right there could be a lot of factors. Maybe they're compensating, but some of it is thought to maybe it's changing your nervous system a little bit. Maybe you're not recruiting quite as well, but most of it's the positive side. It's like if you're injured, not only maybe imagining the injured side moving, but then also work out the other side, because it really helps.
Incredible. Well, you've officially blown my mind. Let's hop out of this sauna. I'm sweating a little bit too much. Let's get some coconut water, get rehydrated, and continue to chat.
Awesome, man.
Let's do it. How'd you like the sauna?
It's awesome. Yeah, every time I'm in the sauna, it's literally one of those things where probably I need to slow down more, because, Tony, I went through a little phase where I was good about doing it. And then I feel like usually I go to the gym and there's a sauna there and I'm just, well, I'm going to rush to get to my workout. And I should really try to build in some time to just have that 20 minutes of sauna. You know, I mean, like we were talking about, there's so much research for it now. And just to have that, whether it's my musculoskeletal system or cardiovascular, just have some of that for, you know, maybe 3 or 4 days a week would be. How many days are you doing it?
Four.
Okay.
Yeah, four or five days. But it's interesting. Some people do it right after their training. I train in the morning and then do the sauna maybe in the early evening.
The studies that were interesting to me on it, you know, were in like places like Finland where everybody's got a sauna. Because, you know, I was listening to a talk on this, and, you know, if you study sauna in the US, the results maybe aren't as trustworthy because the people who are doing sauna also tend to implement other health.
Exactly.
But over there, you know, everybody's just doing sauna.
Interesting.
And so you see all these major, like we're talking about the cardiovascular benefits, and those are in individuals that a lot of them aren't implementing other health behaviors, but they're doing the sauna.
They drink in the sauna
too sometimes. Take a beer in.
Yeah, it's the culture. Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Tom, I want to ask you, you know, we spend so much money as a society on healthcare, but we seem to see a lot of issues and disabilities going up and up and up. What do you feel is the solution for that? Is it more medicine? Is it more medication? Is it more surgeries? Or is it more prehab, more physical therapy, more people taking sovereignty over their own lives and health?
The latter, right? Like, I think all those factors we were talking about earlier, all the things that kind of bombard you and come into life and can influence your health, I think going after those is way more influential than you know, if you look at surgery, for example, and we know how many issues there are with different medications, but with surgery, more and more of the research is that should be a last-ditch kind of effort, you know, try to work on movement, exercise, especially when you're talking about somebody who has pain as their primary complaint. If they don't have some functional problem, like their knees buckling or their shoulders dislocating, like, right, there's some of those that surgery is really useful. Yep. Like, if you have a shoulder that dislocates all the time, we know from the research that that's a place for surgery. You know, you can... if it's really impairing your function. But if you're someone who pain is your primary complaint, surgery is not a great option usually. And a lot of times they'll find in those studies, you see this a lot in back pain, people who elect not to have surgery and people who do have surgery for a primary complaint of back pain. And if you look at them 5 years later, oftentimes the outcomes are the same. You know, so there's a definitely just kind of a time factor. And I think it's way more important to address those other factors. Like, are you getting enough sleep? What's the quality of sleep? Are you drinking a bunch of alcohol? Like, are you stressed out? You know, the nutrition side. Exercise. I mean, exercise is so huge for keeping your nervous system and pain system healthy. It, you know, probably sleep and exercise.
Those are the big two.
I mean, stress. It's hard to, those three. I think if you can really get those kind of figured out, which stress is hard sometimes. People have a job they hate or something, you know, and this happens all the time in physical therapy where, you know, ideally you'd say, well, can you quit that job? And but it's just not realistic. Then you're like, well, okay, we can look at things you can have more control over, your sleep and your exercise, and try to change those things. So.
Your book is kind of like a Bible for like just rehabilitation, and it's got so many exercises and alternative exercises and methods, and it's something that I think people can use really for the rest of their lives. It's something that I'm certainly gonna keep on my shelf forever. If you had to condense things down to maybe three movements just for general health and mobility, what would they be? I don't want to oversimplify things, but I'm a big fan of McGill.
And the big three.
Do you have a big three or five that you would say can really help people stay in good physical health, pain-free rather?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there are common sort of movement patterns that I'm often telling people. If you only have time to do four or five movements, then to think about these kind of movement patterns. And I think, you know, a big one is going to be something for your knee extensors, for your quads, right? Like for your quads. We know quads, like grip strength, and this is getting talked a lot about more, are tied to mortality. So grip strength and quad strength are two of the biggest predictors of all-cause mortality. And basically, it doesn't mean that if you have weak quads, you're going to die. But if you have weak quads, it's sort of an indicator of overall weakness in your body and loss of functional independence. And then that takes people down the road of, oh, now I'm more likely to have a fall and break my hip and have all that whole string of things happen. So looking at like a squat pattern or a lunge, something like that. Now that's of course going to get your glutes too, both your hip extensors and your knee extensors. So I think that would be one I would think about right away. So anything in that pattern, squat, lunge, you know, split squats, Bulgarian split squats, like all those. Another one would be calf raises. So, right? They're so boring, but so important. The calf muscle group is one of the muscle groups that loses the most strength as we age.
So they call it the second heart, right?
It's so important. Yes, your calf muscles are actually one of your most important muscle pumps for returning blood to your heart. So that's why they tell you to do ankle pumps on planes. Because when you pump your ankles, it pumps your soleus and gastrocnemius, your two calf muscles. And there's some stat at one point, it was something like the amount of venous blood that returns to your heart with a minute of ankle pumps is like 263% increase in blood return to your heart. Your calf muscles are really huge for returning blood to your heart and a big part of balance. So if you're looking at falls and just health, we see this huge reduction in calf strength as people age. And the normal strength is to be able to do 25 single leg calf raises. So, and you see people, you know, every decade it will drop. So by the time people get into their 70s, 80s, sometimes they can not even do five. But you can keep that up if you just keep
25
practicing.
25 is like a good baseline.
That's a good baseline. That's the normal strength and studies of healthy people. 25 single leg calf raises. So make that your goal if you don't do calf raises. So I'd say a squat, a calf raise. I would say something for your posterior chain. So a lot of low back pain is associated with posterior chain weakness. So I'm often trying to get people to do things like Supermans or skydivers where they're laying on their stomach. And it's kind of like the opposite of a crunch. You're using your low back muscles to lift your body off the ground. Or there's like the reverse hyper machine in the gym where you hook your legs in. And So we want to work your back extensors. That's
what about the bird dog?
Bird dog, yes, the big three. Yeah, the bird dog is one I give it a lot. Bird dog's a little bit lower load, but that's a great place to start.
Okay.
Like for people with back pain, bird dog is often where we'll start people.
Okay.
And that's, you know, if people haven't seen it, you're on all fours and you're kind of alternating one arm and leg. But that does work your back extensors. And then you'd work towards things like skydivers and Supermans.
Okay.
Those. And then, you know, when you start getting into the upper body, I would say I'd have a rotator cuff exercise.
Mm.
And the big one is usually shoulder external rotation. Okay. So a lot of people have seen this like with a band. They're standing and they're turning out with the band.
Yep.
One I show in the book a lot, which I really like, is laying on your side. So if you were going to work your right arm, you'd lay on your left side.
Mm.
And then you rotate up as far as you can. And that works your external rotators, primarily infraspinatus and teres minor on the backside of your shoulder blade.
Mm.
That is probably arguably the most important shoulder exercise for just keeping shoulder health.
Wow.
So that one. And then lastly, I'd say strengthening your neck.
One we don't hear about too much.
Nobody strengthens their neck, right? So the one that we often are giving to people, and this can help with neck disorders and TMJ, jaw disorders. So, and we see, of course, like so much neck pain. This one that we often use with people is they lay on their back on the ground, and it trains your neck flexors on the front side of your neck. A lot of us don't strengthen those. And you'll catch a lot of people where they're kind of sitting in this position, right? Where they're kind of, their neck flexors aren't really engaged.
Mm.
And so you do this exercise where you lay on your back and you kind of tuck your chin like you're giving yourself a double chin. Mm. And then you lift your head just until it clears the ground and you hold it there.
Mm.
And it's called a neck flexor isometric, but you...
I've done this one. This is when it's tough.
You start shaking. And yeah, so that one in healthy people, the normal holding time is about right around 30 to 40 seconds.
Okay.
So, but if you look at people who have pain or who haven't conditioned their neck, sometimes they can't even make it to 5 or 10 seconds.
Okay. What about the exercises that boxers doing with the weights and the thing on their head and the chain and that's not good, or is it okay?
No, it's okay. Yeah, actually, in some of those athletes like rugby players and wrestlers and boxers, they've actually shown that it can reduce your risk of like brain injuries, concussions and things, because your neck, essentially, if it's stronger, you get less whiplash.
Okay.
In those athletes, for sure, you know, and we were talking about grappling, like grapplers, if you strengthen their neck, rugby players, they tend to have less of those injuries. I mean, it's just another set of muscles. And
yeah, that you
like everywhere in your musculoskeletal system, if you make it stronger, it has a greater capacity for load. And so if you put stress on it, it's less likely to fail. You know, you're less likely to have muscle strains. And yeah, there's even that kind of crazy device. I don't know if you've seen the iron neck. Yeah, right? So there's
it's like a torture device.
My high school, I grew up in Montana, and there's a lot of wrestlers there. Mm. And we actually had some of these machines in our weight room in the high school where you'd like a pad, you know, and you put the pin in and these kind of do different neck exercises.
Interesting.
So, you know, you can go overboard, but I think it's an area of the body that most people neglect in their training programs.
Totally.
So calves, neck, specific low back stuff, rotator cuff. These are just things that get neglected and they're important muscles.
Solid, solid, solid. What about supplements? Let's get into supplements, like adjuncts, like things like fish oil or MSM. What do you feel about those as far as healing? Or
I think they definitely have a place in overall health and for some aspects of healing. They're, of course, like not the foundation. They shouldn't be your foundation, right? Like they'd be, you get all the other things figured out first, the sleep and the exercise and the nutrition. And then if you want to put something else on the top, there's all levels of evidence. If people are ever looking, I'm sure you know examine.com.
Mm-hmm.
They're a great site for going and just looking at what is the actual level of evidence for this and what does it support health-wise. Yep. But I know for me, like the ones that I see constantly that seem to have good evidence are like fish oil, you know, creatine.
Yeah.
You know, creatine's got so much now for your physical body and your brain.
Mm-hmm.
I do take collagen mainly because I'm over 40 now and I just want
to look good skin old. Yeah. There. Yeah, yeah.
So, but I, you know, and joint health too. I was having all these tendon pains. And so collagen reduces as you age. And so my question was, you know, tendons and ligaments, bones are all made up of collagen.
Yep.
So I was kind of curious too, if maybe I supplement with collagen, kind of an experiment on myself, would I have less kind of connective tissue issues.
Mm. Was it the collagen peptides?
Collagen peptides, okay. Yeah. Did you take collagen?
Oh, yeah.
You do?
Yeah, yeah. I used to be just a freaking mad scientist when it came to supplements. Now I do, you know, I don't know, 10 something like that. But yeah, collagen, vitamin C. Mm-hmm. I do the MSM.
Yep.
And others for, you know, vitamin D, vitamin K, two, you know, those, the basics.
Yep. I do some of the vitamin D sometimes. I think I probably have the same little dropper you have with the K2 and stuff. But yeah, I mean, luckily we're somewhere that I try to get just some sun exposure each day too. Lucky to have that. Because you do see, You know, I remember they used to talk about people that live in northern latitudes where they have less sun exposure. There's an increased incidence of certain things like multiple sclerosis. Mm. And a lot of that is thought to be tied to vitamin D deficiencies. I was talking with you, my mom works in psychiatry, and there's a lot of that in psychiatric disorders looking at vitamin D deficiencies. And so I need to take it on myself actually to do blood work again soon because I haven't done that since I was probably 25.
Okay.
So that's something that's been really on my mind lately is just getting regular blood work and checking these things. Because otherwise you're just kind of guessing and, you know, you can kind of look at the ones that have the most evidence and I think you're doing a lot for yourself, but it also is really helpful to check your blood work and see where you're at.
What kind of tests would you, as far as the blood, would just like a comprehensive blood panel?
Yeah, I actually would have to go. I haven't researched that in a little while. I mean, I know there's like, of course, the really general panels that a lot of hospitals would do, but I think you have to dive a little deeper. I hear about some of these panels, you know, you can request looking at different types of things. And I'd honestly need to do a little bit more research. Luckily, there's so much good information out there and people who talk about this stuff. I just need to dive into it a little bit more. I'm definitely not an expert on that side of things.
Yeah, I try to do blood work once a year. I know people who do it every month. Yeah, like a anti-aging or longevity panel is what they call it. And it vitamin D, all your, you know, baseline stuff. It's just good to know where you're at, you know, what you need to, might need to supplement with. There's this old saying in medicine, how do you know unless you look?
For sure. Yeah. Having that objective information is huge. Otherwise, you're just kind of guessing and hoping you're doing the right things. Yeah. And why not take advantage of that stuff? So easy. Just go get your blood taken and check it out.
Super easy. Let's get into aging. And you actually mentioned fall risk. For the elderly, I think many of us have grandparents if we're still lucky, some don't. What are some things that those who are up in age can do to live a healthy life as long as possible?
There's a lot they can do. And the cool thing is that your musculoskeletal system can adapt throughout life, you know, and you can become stronger. And so I think as people age, some of the big things, probably the first, I feel like I'm, you know, just beating on this all the time, but it's really going to be related to resistance training. You know, strength training, not only does it increase muscle strength, which is going to help keep you functional, like we're talking about before, quad strength and grip strength, those two things are highly tied to mortality and they're pure strength. Like how much force can you generate? And I used to work in nursing homes and you'd see this with people that when they would lose, say, quad strength, well, then they need help transferring from one surface to another. So they can't get out of a chair. And then that just takes you down this path towards death, basically. You know, you're just, because as you move less, then you're more likely to get things like pneumonia. Your whole system deconditions. It's not just your musculoskeletal system once you stop moving. So I think strength is a huge one. And tied with that, of course, is mobility. You know, you need to have a certain amount of knee flexion and hip flexion. And, you know, a test you hear about a lot that's been studied is basically just, can you get down to the floor and back up with minimal use of your hands, right? That has been tied to mortality. So, and it's a simple test. You just stand up and then you try to get down on the ground without touching your knees or your hands or the sides of your legs. And if you have to, you just lose a point. So they scored on a point system. You go down and then you get back up. Anytime you touch one of those, you lose one point. And basically the more points you lose, people they tracked, the more likely they were to die sooner. So that test requires some lower extremity mobility to get to the floor and some strength, of course, to get back up. So, and it has a certain amount of balance because if you lose your balance, you also lose a point. Balance is a huge thing that you can just practice too. And there's a test we use in physical therapy called the Berg Balance Score. It's the gold standard for testing balance. And there are multiple different little tests you have to do in it and they get scored and you look at, can the person keep their balance? But probably the two hardest in that whole test at the very end are, can you stand on one leg for just 3 seconds? If you can stand on one leg for 3 seconds, you get the maximum points. And then can you stand in tandem for 3 seconds, which is, can you take a step forward and go heel to toe and maintain that, you know, feet in a straight line? Can you maintain that balance in that position? Those two are the hardest for people with balance issues. And they might sound easy to a lot of listeners, but as you age, there are really important things to think about. And of course, if you can hold longer, that's great. We usually try to get people to be able to hold single leg balance for 30 to 60 seconds, something longer. But, you know, those two, I think looking at, you know, lower body strength, mobility, balance. And on the strength side, the other great thing with strength training is it also increases bone density. And so then if you do fall, you know, there's less likely to have a fracture. I think if you look at the stats on hip fractures, which are so common in older people because they tend to fall to the side, land on the side of their hip, it's something like around 30% die in the year following their hip fracture because of they become fearful of falling again. They become more sedentary, more deconditioned and weak. And it just, it goes down that path again. So as you age, those are the big ones. I'm always talking about resistance training because I think if you look at the evidence for it, strength training with just kind of simple movements like we were talking about before, big muscle groups, squats, lunges, deadlifts, things like that, pushes, like pressing, pulling, those, I think, if you look at biggest bang for the buck, strength training is where it's at.
Okay. Okay. Huh. Building those muscles or working them at least. Yeah. Wow. Yep. Let's get into your book. Like I said, this is something that I think people can have forever. No matter what they're going through, if they feel some type of pain, they could probably find what to do in the book. What made you write it? And what do you hope that people take from Rehab Science?
I did write it basically in thinking about what you were just talking about there. Sort of after being a PT now for 17 years, most humans kind of fall into the same patterns of pain issues and injuries. And so I would see this not only with patients in the clinic working with them, but then, you know, I've been writing things on social media now for a little over 6 years. And it was hearing a lot of the same questions, people having these same kind of problems. And so the goal with the book was to create a resource that could be more nuanced and go into more depth. And it basically included the 50 most common kind of orthopedic issues, which really you could probably distill it down to like 20. There's probably 20 that most humans get. You know, because on social media, you can only go into so much depth, right? And people just don't see things. And I never wanted people to look at posts there and think that was the whole picture and everything that rehab and physical therapy was. So like we were talking about before, just how important pain education is. How is pain different than an injury? And the first 10 chapters of the book really go into that science and are written in a way that everyone can understand. It's not meant just for practitioners. So And I know a lot of people skip that and just go, because the back part of the book, the biggest part is the rehab section, which is all the programs and, you know, pictures of me doing the exercise. It's sort of like, it was meant to be that you, sort of a self-guided rehab book. So if you had tennis elbow or plantar fasciitis or sciatica, you could open to that program and just have something to start implementing and learn a little bit about that condition. But I'm hoping that people, once they get into a program and maybe something improves, they'll want to go back to the beginning and learn about pain and injury. Because it really does, it sort of protects your mind, I think. We know that people, you know, who have pain often feel anxious. There's sometimes fear surrounding it. And you can take away some of those feelings if you understand it better. Really, the goal was to have this sort of like, somebody called it an injury Bible or an injury encyclopedia. Kind of have this reference like you were talking about where you can just pick it up and find something. The other side of it to me is that even though it's called rehab, it's not just, the exercises are not just for rehab. You know, you and I both know we like going and doing strength training at the gym. Strength training, mobility work, all of that also is prehab in nature.
Yeah.
So even though the book is talking about specific conditions, like you might open to the rotator cuff program and see mobility and strength exercises in the phases of the program. But even if you don't have a problem, doing especially the phase three resistance training exercises will help protect those tissues. They're also prehab exercises, but most people have this assumption that if it's a rehab exercise, you only do it during rehab.
No.
Right? You keep that stuff going. That's how you keep your musculoskeletal system healthy. So, you know, because Rehab Science is who I've always been online, but we were a little conflicted on that title. Because like, you just don't want people to think it collects dust until I've got an injury.
An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, right?
Big time. Big time.
Beautiful, beautiful. I want to play a quick game with you.
Yeah.
This is a game I like to call the five best. Tom, what was the best investment you ever made?
Education. Yeah, best investment. I am so thankful for the time spent. There was a lot of stress during that period, of course, and you don't see where it's taking you in life. But because I care so much about health, that education that I went through, you know, I did an exercise science degree and then physical therapy, that has, I think, just made everything else better in life. Like, I'm lucky enough to be healthy and have no functional impairments and things and not a lot of pain. But I think that education has been huge in helping keep me healthy. And that's allowed me to enjoy other things in life.
Awesome. Yeah, that's the secret, education. The best book you ever read?
Recursion.
Oh, okay.
It's a multiverse type book.
Ooh.
It's really good. You got to check it out.
Sounds interesting.
I'll send it to you.
Multiverse.
Yes. Yes. You know, I'm always so focused on my sleep, but when that book, I can't read books like this very often because I was up till 2 a.m. like hiding in the bathroom trying to finish it. And Kirsten was so annoyed. Yeah, it's not good for my health to have books like that.
It doesn't make you fall asleep because people read to fall asleep, but you just stay up reading it.
Yeah.
Is that good?
It's a good one.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll send it to you.
Best time in your life?
Right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Best time. This whole journey, I mean, I feel so grateful. Gratitude is just always happening. I am always feeling this sense of it right now. And I have so much to be thankful for. Chokes me up a little bit thinking about it. But to be where I'm at, I've always, since I was a kid, wanted to have kind of these platforms where I could influence people positively. Mm. And to be in a position now to have that, have this book. Mm. I have two awesome girls that are 9 and 12. I'm healthy, you know, and I'm going around meeting people like you. So it's awesome. So
it's a gift, man.
Yeah, this time period.
Awesome. Best quote you ever heard?
The best quote, and I'm going to totally butcher this, is a Mark Twain quote. Gosh, maybe you can remind me, remember what it's about worrying about things in the future. Versus that usually the things that torment us aren't the things that are happening now. It's the things that we're thinking about.
He's like, painful things in my life, most of them never happen or something like that.
Exactly. That one. Exactly. I would say that one. And the one other one that I often reflect back on, humility is not thinking less of oneself, but thinking about oneself less. That one I think is huge. Humility is thinking less of oneself, but thinking about oneself less.
That's beautiful.
I love that one because, you know, it's easy in this world to get wrapped up sometimes when you are seeing things become sort of successful and grow to start to feel like, oh yeah, look at me. It's pretty cool. But to really stay focused on that mission of helping other people, it's not about you. It's and thinking about other people and serving other people.
That's it. That's it. Here's a quote from Henry Ford. He said, a business devoted to service will have only one worry when it comes to profits. They will be embarrassingly large.
Your content's some of the most inspirational around those topics. So I know you're no stranger. Should have just asked you for the service quotes.
That's what it's about. That's why we're here for each other. We're just walking each other home, and you're helping people walk each other home pain free, you know? And that's amazing. You're providing so many gifts to people. And I'm sure you see the messages and you hear the stories. I can already tell you've saved many lives, because actually when I was dealing with some pain, I've seen some of your content and it's helped me personally.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is amazing to see just these little snippets of information and how much it can help people.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, a lot of countries in the world don't have access to good care, right? And that's amazing on social media, is you can interact with people who are in Africa or in the Middle East or somewhere where they don't have, might not even be physical therapy in that country, or it's way too expensive. And it doesn't have to be out of this country too, obviously, but it's amazing to see people have a piece of technology and be able to learn about their body and get better.
Access. I got access. What's the best way that people can deal with pain, you would say? Is there a best way? Is it?
It varies a little bit depending on the type of pain, right? But I think at the end of the day, the best starting point, maybe even regardless of the type of pain you have, is to sit and be quiet and get to know yourself. So much physical pain is associated with psychological suffering and pain. And I think that's such the benefit of meditative type practices, where if you can go inside and eliminate some of the distractions, that's your best opportunity to really figure out, what is this pain teaching me? I think just so many people, we're often going so fast that we're not aware of the messages from our body, and that is the best starting point. Can you sit and be still and listen to what the pain is trying to tell you?
Oof. And just that shift of meaning makes a huge difference. Last question. Well, I got you here. It's the magic wand question. If you could wave a magic wand at the planet, and tomorrow when you woke up, your magic wand wish was granted, what would your magic wand wish be?
The magic wand would be access. You know, I think, like you mentioned earlier, so many of these problems, I mean, I can be so myopic, and because of my profession and focused on pain and injury, but so many of the problems in the world are because of a lack of access, people having access. And so knowledge about your body is just one of those facets of that whole problem. And so I think having access to information and education is such an important item in the beginning of someone's development. I mean, my kids right now are 9 and 12, and I see this. They have been lucky enough to have a school nearby that's good. And you see how much that, watching them develop, Because when you're a kid, you don't think about that, right? You're not thinking about, you aren't aware of, you have no idea. But watching them develop and watching how that's shaping their brains and what that's the trajectory that's going to set up for them. So I think whether it's pain and injury and having access to information that helps you with your health and taking care of your body, or information related to all the other aspects of life, that would be the thing I would change. That magic wand, everybody would have just access to good education.
Yeah, that's it. It's a great wish. It's a great wish. Tom, where can people go to pick up your book or learn more about you?
Yeah, so I am at Rehab Science, mainly on Instagram and YouTube. So the YouTube videos are a little bit longer form of the Instagram stuff. The book is with all the major book retailers, but Amazon and Barnes & Noble, if people are internationally located, then there's a bookstore called Blackwell's that ships internationally in the UK, and those are kind of the main spots.
Awesome. 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 Tom Walters, Rehab Science, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. This is awesome.
Sauna Sessions.
So grateful to share about this information. I hope it's helpful to the audience.
I think it is. I think you inspired a lot of people, and you're healing a lot of people just from your words and education. So thank you so much for sharing.
Thanks for having me.